The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
And today's episode is about AI, specifically sentient AI and what it means to be human and interact with AI. Our guest today is Dr. Robert Epstein. He is an American psychologist, professor, author, and journalist. He earned his PhD in psychology at Harvard University in 1981, was editor-in-chief of Psychology Today, a visiting scholar at the University of California, San Diego, and the founder and director emeritus of the Cambridge Center for Behavioral Studies in Concord, Massachusetts. He is currently senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. He is also one of the founders of the Loebner Prize. The Loebner Prize was launched in 1991 and awards prizes to the computer program or chatbot that deceives the judges into thinking it is human. The competition will end when judges believe responses are from a human after interacting with the system via text, speech, and images. So far, it appears there is a long way to go. I should also mention Dr. Epstein's book, which is most relevant to this episode. It is called Parsing the Turing, the Turing Test Sourcebook, Philosophical and Methodological Issues in the Quest for the Thinking Computer. Welcome, Dr. Epstein.
My pleasure.
So I'd like to dive in with a quote from the Pew Research, AI and the Future of Humans. This is a quote from you, shortened just a little bit. By 2030, it is likely that AIs will have achieved a type of sentience, even if it is not human-like. We will have no way of dislodging them. How they decide to deal with humanity, to help us, ignore us, or destroy us, will be entirely up to them, and there is no way currently to predict which avenue they will choose. Also, there is at least a reasonable possibility that they will swat us like the flies we are, the possibility that Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, and others have warned about. There is no way, to my knowledge, of stopping this future from emerging. Wow, that's a pretty somber prediction.
Yes, but I'm pretty sure it's true. There is no way to stop the development of these AIs. Absolutely no way, because there are financial incentives across the board for developing every little component of what will eventually be a sentient AI. So in other words, we want, you know, a machine to answer the calls that come into our business, and we want it to fool people into thinking it's a person and handle their problems. And if you're running a big site like Ashley Madison, which is for people who want to cheat on their spouses, you know, you want people to pay your company money because they think they're actually conversing with a beautiful woman on your website. But of course, you don't want to hire beautiful women to do that. You just want to use bots. And so that's been moving forward by leaps and bounds. The point is, there are hundreds and hundreds of uses for AI in one form or another. There's a tremendous effort to improve all of these little, I call them components of, you know, of the real AI. And yeah, that's going to just keep moving forward faster and faster and faster. There's no way that's going to stop. And at some point we will cross a threshold, and it could be by 2030, but we will cross a threshold, and we might not even know that we've crossed the threshold. But the point is, there will emerge a kind of true intelligence, human-like or unrecognizable as human, that will happen. And from that point on, it's hard to predict not just, you know, what's going to happen with the AI. It's hard to predict the future of humanity from that point on.
Dr. Epstein, you mentioned something earlier, which is somewhat interesting, i.e. being fooled by AI. This is happening today. However, you have an interesting story. You are the expert, yet in 2007, you were fooled by a chatbot. Can you go into that a little bit and let us know what happened?
Yes, I published about this in Scientific American, and it is a bit embarrassing, a bit humiliating. I think that was part of my title in the article. Yes. I published. But indeed, at that point, I was single. I had gone online to various websites to try to meet a female partner. And one of the women I was chatting with said she was from Russia. That to me sounded fine. All four of my grandparents came to the US from Russia. So, you know, just began communicating with her, and she sent me photos. And her English was terrible. So I forgave that, obviously, because she's in Russia. Her English was awful. So I to me, that was a good excuse for not getting on the phone with her. So I kind of understood that. So I was very forgiving, in other words, of the shortcomings in her emails. But I did begin to notice something, which was that she wasn't very responsive to particular questions I was asking. And, you know, this went on for weeks. In fact, it went on for 3 months altogether. And I was getting increasingly uncomfortable. And then one day, she mentioned that she'd gone for a walk in the park with her friend. And I just didn't sound right. And I looked up the weather in the part of Russia where she supposedly lived, and it was, you know, freezing. 10 below zero or something. I mean, it was, so I said, wow, that's great. But is that common for you to go out for a walk in the park when it's so cold? Because I looked up the temperature. And of course, this was another direct question, and she didn't really answer direct questions. So she didn't answer that. Finally, my head just switched, and I woke up, I suppose you could say, from this dream. And so I began to act like I was a judge in a Turing test, asking very specific questions, looking for specific answers. And then I did one of the ultimate tests, which, by the way, we never allowed during the Loebner competitions. And that is, I just sent her a bunch of mixed up crazy alphabet letters. And she responded with another nice email. So in other words, this was not a person. This was a computer program.
Yeah.
And I, certainly one of the most knowledgeable people on the planet about such things, I was fooled for 3 months.
Well, what's really interesting is that, yes, I mean, here you are, you're one of the founders of the Loebner Prize, and here you are fooled by a chatbot. But you also said in your writing that you felt perhaps one of the reasons why you and perhaps others are easily fooled by chatbots like this, whereas we may not be, say, for customer service chatbots, is that it touches on our libido. Can you elaborate a little bit? Are we more prone to believe chatbots if they in some way incite an emotion in us, you know, libido or, you know, anger or something else?
Well, anything that removes our critical thinking, anything that reduces our critical thinking, that's going to make us more vulnerable to believing we're interacting with a human. So, for example, a couple of years ago, The Guardian reported, so they're in the UK, they reported that the Turing test had been passed. Of course, I was stunned. So I started reading up on that. And you know, I ended up publishing a letter in The Guardian pointing out that no, the Turing test has not been passed. What had happened was that someone had programmed a computer to behave as if it's a small child. That's what happened. And sure enough, if you interact with that kind of computer program, you make all kinds of allowances. You see, in other words, your
expectations are
different. Critical thinking is turned off. You know, interacting with a little child, you expect responses to be, simple and vague and silly and so on. And you know, if you ask a specific question, get a silly answer, you don't think twice about it. So anything that lowers our guard, and that's what happened with me, of course, I had lowered my guard because of this, the programmer had sent me pictures of a very attractive woman. And so, of course, my guard was lowered. By the way, in fact, this was not in my article, but this is very interesting. I was also corresponding with other people, of course, at the time. And another conversation that had been going, not for very long, no more than, I would say, than a week or so, it ended abruptly when I got an email from a programmer who, in fact, was in the UK, who said, you know, I know who you are. And he said, I just can't let you continue conversing with whatever her name was, Mary. He said, because she's not real. I programmed her, he said, and I'm very proud of the fact that the pictures I created from scratch. In other words, like, he created her literally, her face from scratch. And he was so proud of that. He said, but I just can't put you through this. He said, because I know what you do.
Wow. So he was expecting you to be on the lookout for testing it as an AI, not actually looking to converse with her.
No, quite the opposite. And that's why he contacted me. It's quite the opposite. He did, you know, he was fooling me and he didn't want to keep fooling me just out of respect for the work I do. And no, I was very grateful to him. No, I was not on my guard, not at all. Because if you go onto a website like that, again, wishful thinking rules the day.
So we've mentioned twice, at least, the Turing test. We should spell out what the Turing test is.
Well, way, way back in 1950, when computers barely existed, a very, very brilliant man named Alan Turing, he published an article. It's absolutely so astonishing because, again, computers were so primitive. They were enormous. All they did for pretty much were very fast calculations. They didn't use any kind of language, but he predicted that someday a computer will be able to converse with a person, and it will do so well that it could fool an average person for about 5 minutes, about 70% of the time, into thinking that it's a person. And he said, eventually, when you can't tell whether you're conversing with a person or a computer, he said, at that point, the computer has basically crossed the threshold. And in effect, it has a kind of consciousness has now been achieved. He said, and, you know, how would you disprove that? You know, you really couldn't. In other words, if you could converse with this entity endlessly, hour after hour, day after day, week after week, and you can't distinguish it from a person, then it must be like a person. And so he said this back in 1950. It turns out that by the year 2000, we indeed had reached the point almost exactly as he described. In other words, chatbots could fool people for a few minutes into thinking they were people. And of course, when we set up the Loebner competition, which was 1991, we were testing this, you know, year by year in a very formal way. And all I can say is Turing was correct. I mean, but having said that, you know, we all thought, even in the 1970s, that we'd cross that threshold tomorrow. I mean, and then in the 1980s, we thought we'd cross that threshold tomorrow and so on. And when we started the competition, we thought, well, God, these machines, they're just going to get better and better and better every year, you know. So, yes, this year, this first year when our contest made the front page of the New York Times, okay, no computer crossed over this threshold into the realm of humans, but, you know, could happen next year, could happen the year after, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that contest has been running now for almost 30 years, and the programs, the bots that participate in this contest every year, they're really not much better than they were 30 years ago. And they just can't fool people for very long. And we're not even close at this point. By the way, a little footnote here that, and I love this, the annual Loebner competitions are now held each year at Bletchley Park.
In the
UK. And that is where Alan Turing, during World War II, ran a top secret project to decode the German code that was used in communications. And of course, this tale has now been told in movies and books, and all the material has finally been declassified. But the point is, that's where Turing actually built this machine that did break the German code and helped tremendously in allowing the Allies to defeat the Germans. And by the way, the UK, no one ever revealed that they had cracked the code, and of course, how it was done. And Turing, unfortunately, was not given credit during his lifetime, and he ended up committing suicide when he was quite young.
Sad story.
Yeah, but and excellent movie with Benedict Cumberbatch, The Imitation Game, lays that all out fairly well.
Yes.
Although it wasn't the lack of credit that caused him to commit suicide.
That's true.
I'd like to drill down a little bit on this. In 30 years, they haven't actually, the bots have not actually gotten a lot better, because we can compare and contrast that to, chess playing games, where chess is thought to be entirely a game of logic, but we've reduced that programmatically to, searching for moves and so on. Although new computers, big computers, can actually learn a new game in a day and beat the masters on day two, sort of thing. So the point being, as computing power increases, other areas of what was thought to be, the kind of computation and massive logic application necessary to do AI, have made significant progress. But somehow we're not covering the full gamut of human interaction or human thoughts. Any particular thoughts about why it is that maybe, what's missing? If it's not computational power, what's missing?
Well, first of all, I should say that when I was working on that book, which is called Parsing the Turing Test, it is a Turing Test source book. I said in the introduction that, yes, eventually we're going to pass this test. And I said, well, we'll pass it one way or another. I said, because eventually computers are, they're just going to have so much capacity and work so fast that, it'll be easy to simulate human behavior. But we've already passed that point. In other words, if you pretend that the human brain is a computer, which it definitely is not, but if you pretend that it is, and you kind of measure its parameters as if it were a computer, measure its capabilities as if it were a computer, we've passed that point. Our machines are so fast now, and they have huge memories, and they have access to all knowledge on the internet. But we're not even close, after all this time to having a computer, reach the level of sophistication wherein we would say, okay, it's conscious, it's self-aware, it's intelligent in the way a human is intelligent. Not even close. So why is this? Well, yes, there have been advances in AI. Okay, so I can't argue on that point. But the advances have mainly been in two areas. One area is game playing. And game playing is such a constrained activity. A game, not the game of life, but a game like Go or chess, has a very small set of rules. And, each game is played in a very constrained environment, small set of rules. So yeah, if you've got a computer that's got incredible speed, and a few strategies programmed into it, yes, it can learn to play the game better than a human can. That's true. So game playing, yep, they got that. And the other is pattern recognition. And that means that a computer now can read, for example, an X-ray and looking for abnormalities just as well as a radiologist can, and in some cases, even better than a radiologist can. And that has to do with recognizing patterns. And that means recognizing patterns that are visual, or they could be in, you know, in sound, you know, in any medium, really. Okay, pattern recognition, they got that too.
But and had no preconceptions.
Yeah. Well, the point is, though, that where we have not made much progress is in what we would really call, you know, human intelligence. And the reason for that is because we don't understand even our own intelligence. Mm-hmm. So we've really made very, very little progress there in creating a computer program that behaves intelligently as humans behave. And of course, especially using language to demonstrate that it has reached this level of intelligence. And of course, that is the core of the problem. That is the core. That is what Turing was writing about. And we're just not really getting there. And I actually published a piece, it's the most widely read piece I've ever published for Eon Magazine, which is based in London. It's called The Empty Brain. And it crashed their servers when they published it. Very soon had 160,000 shares on Facebook, 2 million views. And it's a piece in which I point out that, you know, we are not like computers. We're not. We're organisms, and that this analogy that's been drawn, you know, between computers and people, computers and the human brain, is a deeply flawed analogy. And we're probably because we're so stuck in that model, we are probably missing out on opportunities, number one, to understand what the brain is actually doing, because we think it's a computer and it's not. But number two, we're probably also missing out on the other side of the equation, and that is to say we're probably not making real strides in creating human-like intelligence in computers, because we don't understand human intelligence. So on both sides, you see this connection that we've drawn between computers and people is a very deep, and I think there's been a cost to it, because we've been using this model, this metaphor of intelligence now for more than 50 years, and it's we can't shake it. We're just stuck with it, and it's a
so if that's a dead end, then is part of the problem that we're trying to make computers, bots that can talk to us like us, and to your point about maybe a type of sentience, even if it is not human-like, maybe we should be looking at recognizing sentience in a different way than simply expressing thoughts in ways that we recognize?
Well, yes, I'd say that recognizing that we don't really understand human intelligence, recognizing that, you know, computers don't operate the way organisms operate, even when we try to emulate, I think we're kind of moving forward a bit slowly on the key issue, because we're not thinking about how can I enlarge machine intelligence in a variety of ways that aren't necessarily human. Now, I happen to believe that even if we're not at some point, I think a computer program will emerge that, number one, wants to survive. Number two, for information and without end. Okay, so it wants to survive. It knows how to reach out and get information, and it is in some can not only examine through cameras and microphones. It can not only examine the world around it, but it is self-aware in the sense that it can examine its own functioning.
I think that's self-awareness.
Well, that's, I mean, if you can, if you can react to an apple in front of you and pick it up and take a bite, right? That's that's great. That's good for survival. But if you can also and then later comment on the fact that you did it, see, that implies self-awareness and certainly a form of consciousness. If at some point a computer certainly is going to reach that, they'll be able to react to the world around them, but they'll start to react to aspects of their own behavior. Now, at that point, they're getting very, very close to what we call self-awareness. And again, given that these computers now are more and more capable amounts of knowledge, well, all human knowledge, really, through the internet, I think a threshold is going to be crossed, and we won't even realize that it's been crossed. And from that point on, yes, because, again, there are three possibilities. This first entity, or this community of entities, or this world mind, maybe, might decide to work with us, communicate, and ignore us. There's a wonderful movie, I think it's called Her, if I'm not mistaken. At the end of the movie, this this AI that has basically become the girlfriend of the main, at the end of the movie, she disappears. She just disappears. So these truly intelligent entities that will emerge, they might ignore us. That's number two. And then number three, they can destroy us in seconds. In seconds, they can destroy us. You could say there's another possibility too, which is which actually was inspired by the work of a friend of mine, Ray Kurzweil. And in transcendence, once we humans have realized that a true AI is basically jumped into the internet and in theory could do anything to us, to protect ourselves from it, we shut down I think all electricity. In other words, we literally go back to the Stone Age so that we're not attacked by an AI. So I think we're headed toward in time this kind of crossroad in human history where it's impossible to say, you know, what's going to happen from that moment forward. Some people call singularity, or at least the digital singularity. There's no way we cannot go there. We will definitely go there. I don't know if I'll be alive. I want to see it because, again, it could turn out badly. And some very, very capable people, Stephen Hawking among them, Elon Musk, they have expressed true terror that this entity, in fact, will destroy us. Because we're not in any way doing anything to protect our computers. That's the problem. So this entity, if it emerges, for example, if it emerges on a computer sitting in a lab at Stanford University, it will probably within, you know, a few milliseconds or maybe even nanoseconds, it will jump into the internet. And that's why in my writings, I refer sometimes to the internet as the internest, because I think we might look back someday, if we're still around, we might look back and realize that all these years that we've been building the internet, we've just been building a nest for AIs. And once they jump in, we can't get rid of them, number one. And number two, they have the means to destroy us because they're basically in control of weapon systems, all financial transactions, most communications. You know, it goes on and on.
You might have kindred spirits in Yuval Noah Hariri in his book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. He does talk about artificial intelligence not as singular entities, but really as, you know, sort of peer-to-peer networks And he uses examples like blockchain networks and, you know, cryptocurrencies as precursors of such a thing, which in fact, as you say, would be a lot more terrifying.
Well, it's a good thing that we're all learning how to shelter in place and right. You know, turn off all of our 21st century gizmos so that we're ready for this.
Right.
Well, the thing is, what I have to stress, though, is that we really don't know. And, you know, when I see statements like the ones Hawking made before he passed away, my immediate thought is, hey, you're jumping the gun here. You're asserting something that literally by its very nature cannot be predicted. We're talking about an entity or a community of entities, a network of entities, that will operate at speeds that, you know, are almost unfathomable to us, and will have access to so much knowledge that no organism could ever master. The kind of thinking it will do will be a new kind of thinking. How could we possibly predict what such entities will do once that threshold is crossed? That threshold could be crossed, and it's possible that we just won't even know it, because these entities are going to be so different than we are that they just might have no interest whatsoever in communicating with us.
And it seems that it's somewhat interesting in that even though the future that you are potentially portraying, the potential future that could happen, is where these entities have virtually no empathy for us, right now some of the interesting experiments that were done demonstrate that we end up having empathy for robots, even though we intellectually know that they cannot feel. There was a experiment done by in a grocery chain store in Scotland. And it was a version of SoftBank's Pepper humanoid. It was called Fabio, and he was supposed to be a supermarket attendant. He was supposed to ham it up with customers, maybe provide them information about where certain products were sold and whatnot. And apparently he performed abysmally and he was fired. And after that, some of the researchers were somewhat surprised that the folks at the grocery store, some of them were crying when the robot was put away. Right. So we clearly have emotion towards these robots, whereas they do not. And just to bring a little bit of science fiction in that, I don't know whether you've seen Westworld from HBO.
A little bit.
Yeah. And in it, they have these robots and AI, these sort of AI powered robots, where the humans are not really supposed to have feelings towards them because they can kill them. But the robots do have feelings, mostly of aggression. And so where do you think the future is? Do you think that we will continue to have this sort of empathy for these robots, whereas these robots and AI are going to progress and become more, you know, perhaps self-aware and not have any for us?
Again, it's so hard to say. I will say this, though. I see over and over again the claim made, sometimes by experts, sometimes just, you know, people who are just expressing their opinion, that computers can't have emotions. Mm. And of course, that was a theme throughout the whole Star Trek series, because, you know, Mr. Data always wanted to have emotions. And, it's a very old theme. And it's completely wrong. That assertion is completely wrong. In other words, I've been programming almost my whole life. If I set out to program an AI that I wanted to have emotions, I could do that very easily. It's a simple thing to do. It's a simple thing to do. You could create an entity that will feel pain, for example, if it's damaged. Mm. That would, you know, if it's has a ability to express itself vocally, that would scream under conditions, certain conditions, that would cry under certain conditions. That's trivially easy. I mean, even humans, you know, I have five kids, so I've seen this happen. Even we humans have to be trained to talk about our emotions, to label our emotions. And in some cultures, people express a lot of emotions. For example, Latin America. I have an ex-wife who's from there, and so I've kind of seen that and in her family. And then we have other cultures where emotions are suppressed when people don't express much emotion. For example, the UK. So, learning for humans, learning about emotions and whether to express them, whether even to feel them. I mean, that's normal for humans. We could easily build computers that experience emotions, experience pain, experience grief. There's no problem there at all. So,
debunk that myth.
Yeah, I know that's absolutely, it's just wrong. It's absolutely wrong. Mm-hmm. I love science fiction, but I literally will just put down the book or walk out of a movie if that becomes the theme, that Mr. Data,
Yeah.
Or it's just like in The Wizard of Oz, which character was it who wanted a heart?
The lion, I think.
The lion wanted courage.
The Tin Man.
Oh, courage. Tin Man wanted the heart.
Tin Man wanted the heart. That's right. And that's, as they say, that's an old theme. That's, that's how we're different from whatever. But easy.
But the good news is, in Star Trek Picard, they pick up that theme about Data, and you'll be glad to know that they solve that problem in the next generation of androids. But when you said Star Trek to begin with, I thought, yes, indeed, Star Trek, and I thought Mr. Spock, who did have emotions and worked very hard to suppress them, and that was the source of many, many episodes' themes. But if I were to sum up what I would take away from what we've discussed so far, and I think we are at that point where we should be summing up, my biggest takeaways here would be that that we don't know when or how we're going to cross that barrier and actually have sentient computing programs. I'm not going to say devices because it's not clear that they will be tied to individual devices. So sentience in computer programming. We also don't know what it's going to look like, right? That it clearly may not resemble anything that we're familiar with. So testing for its existence by looking for stuff that we find familiar is maybe not necessarily definitive.
That's right.
And we have no idea where it's all going to go, but that's okay because that kind of defines life in the real world anyway.
Well, Hawking and others have pointed out that there are reasons to believe that humanity someday just wipes itself out. Mm. This sounds a bit like it's just science fiction, but it's not. It's quite rational. One of the reasons one could make such a statement that that we don't make it is because if it is possible to travel in time, and there are some serious physicists, who actually entertain the idea, it's not entirely ridiculous. But if that's true, then eventually we figure that out. Maybe it takes 100 years, maybe it takes 1,000 years. Eventually, we figure it out, and then people go back in time. And at first, of course, it's very few, and it's incredibly expensive. It costs who knows $1 trillion, whatever. But keep going forward in time. Keep going forward. It gets cheaper and cheaper. More and more people can do it. And what we should be seeing all around us are visitors from the future. They should be literally in tour buses going up and down the street. there isn't anyone. In other words, no one has come back in time. So as I said in one of my books, this tells us either that time travel is impossible or that humanity is impossible.
Wow.
And these entities will definitely exist. I think, unfortunately, there will be people among us who will attack them. That's kind of what we do. That's how we deal with problems, is we attack. And that could be our downfall, because if we attack, these entities that are living in the internest that we have so graciously and kindly built for them over a period of decades, we're in trouble. If we attack them, they could easily destroy us. So we might be building the means of our own destruction.
So I think I'm going to amend my earlier statement about my big takeaways and add that I think that I really hope for sentience that actually is more likely understand it. And for the same reason that I'm not anxious to have space aliens actually visit the planet, because it terrifies me that we won't be able to relate. We have challenges enough trying to get along with people of the same provenance.
Yes.
So
for sure.
Let's hope for empathy. For AI with empathy.
Well, we could build it. See, that's the thing. And that's, you know, a number of people in computer science have pointed this out. We could, in theory, be building machines deliberately that are incapable of hurting us. And of course, Isaac Asimov explored that. In his books with his three laws of robotics, and eventually a fourth law was added, a zeroth law, which is fascinating. But the point is, machines were built, AIs were built, you know, in Asimov's stories with constraints on them so that they would not hurt us, or so the likelihood that they would hurt us is nil. And we're not doing that. That's one of the, again, it's one of the things that people, you know, it's caused some people who know a lot about AI to be very concerned, because we're not even thinking in those terms. We don't want to build machines or intelligences that have no constraints on them. We don't want to build intelligences that might be hostile to us, but at the moment we're not thinking in those terms, and we're designing systems that have no constraints whatsoever.
And we should. I guess that's one of the takeaways. Well, Dr. Epstein, thank you so much for giving us your time. Really appreciate it.
Yes, very much.
Absolutely. And thank you for taking such an interest in this topic. Obviously, we'd like to educate people about what's coming and maybe how we should protect ourselves. So I appreciate what you're doing.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.